Jack, in her eyes a brooding question, which on a nod or a shake of Ma's head might become tragedy or joyous excitement.
Ma?
She held up the boxes, jerked them up and down to make them attractive. Now you put them back. The tragedy began to form in Ruthie's eyes. Pa said,
They're only a nickel apiece. Them little fellows work good today.
Well, the excitement began to steal into Ruthie's eyes. All right. Ruthie turned and fled. Halfway to the door, she caught Winfield and rushed him out the door into the evening. Uncle John fingered a pair of canvas gloves with yellow leather palms, tried them on, took them off, and laid them down. He moved gradually to the liquor shelves, and he stood studying the labels on the bottles. Ma saw him. Pa, she said, and motioned with her head toward Uncle John. Pa lounged over to him.
Getting thirsty, John? No, I ain't. Just wait till cotton's done, said Pa. Then you can go on a hell of a drunk. Tain't sweating me none, Uncle John said. I'm working hard and sleeping good. No dreams nor nothing. Just seen you sort of drooling out of them bottles. I didn't hardly see 'em. Funny thing. I want to buy stuff. Stuff I don't need. Like to get one of them safety razors. Thought I'd like to have some of them gloves over there. Awful cheap. Can't pick no cotton with gloves, said Pa. I know that. And I don't need no safety razor neither. Stuff setting out there, you just feel like buying it whether you need it or not.
Ma called, Come on, we got everything. She carried a bag. Uncle John and Pa each took a package. Outside, Ruthie and Winfield were waiting, their eyes strained, their cheeks puffed and full of crackerjack.
Won't eat no supper, I bet, Ma said.
People streamed toward the boxcar camp. The tents were lighted. Smoke poured from the stovepipes. The Jodes climbed up their catwalk and into their end of the boxcar. Rose of Sharon sat on a box beside the stove. She had a fire started, and the tin stove was wine-colored with heat.
Did you get milk? She demanded.
Yeah, right here.
Give it to me. I ain't had any since noon.
She thinks it's like medicine.
That nurse lady says so.
You got potatoes ready?
Right there, peeled.
We'll fry 'em, said Ma. Got pork chops. Cut up them potatoes in the new fry pan, and throw in a onion. You fellows go out and wash, and bring in a bucket of water. Where's Ruthie and Winfield? They ought to wash. They each got crackerjack, Ma told Rose of Sharon. Each got a whole box. The men went out to wash in the stream. Rose of Sharon sliced the potatoes into the frying pan and stirred them about with a knife point. Suddenly the tarpaulin was thrust aside. A stout, perspiring face looked in from the other end of the car.
How'd you all make out, Miss Jode?
Ma swung around.
Why, evening, Miss Wainwright. We done good. 3½. 357 exact.
We done $4.
Well, said Ma, course there's more of you.
Yeah, Jonas is growing up, having pork chops, I see.
Winfield crept in through the door.
Ma!
Hush a minute.
Yes, my man just loves pork chops.
I'm cooking bacon, said Mrs. Wainwright. Can you smell it cooking?
No, can't smell it over these here onions in the potatoes.
She's burning.
Mrs. Wainwright cried, and her head jerked back.
Ma,
Winfield said. What, you sick from crackerjack?
Ma, Ruthie told.
Told what?
About Tom.
Ma stared.
Told.
Then she knelt in front of him.
Winfield. Who she tell?
Embarrassment seized Winfield.
He backed away. Well, she only told a little bit.
Winfield, now you tell what she said.
She didn't eat all her Cracker Jack. She kept some, and she ate just one piece at a time, slow like she always done, and she says, bet you wished you had some left.
Winfield, Ma demanded, you tell now.
She looked back nervously at the curtain.
Rosa Sharn, you go over talk to Ms. Wainwright so she don't listen.
How about these here potatoes?
I'll watch 'em. Now you go. I don't want her listening at that curtain.
The girl shuffled heavily down the car and went around the side of the hung tarpaulin. Ma said,
now, Winfield, you tell.
Like I said, she ate just one little piece at a time, and she bust some in two so it'd last longer.
Go on, hurry up.
Well, some kids come around, and course they tried to get some, but Ruthie, she just nibbled and wouldn't give 'em none. So they got mad, and one kid grabbed her Cracker Jack box.
Winfield, you tell quick about the other.
I am, he said. So Ruthie got mad and chased him, and she fit one, and then she fit another. And then one big girl up and licked her, hit her a good one. So then Ruthie cried, and she said she'd get her big brother, and he'd kill that big girl. And that big girl said, oh yeah, well, she got a big brother too.
Winfield was breathless in his telling.
So then they fit, and that big girl hit Ruthie a good one, and Ruthie said her brother'd kill that big girl's brother, and that big girl said how about if her brother killed our brother, and then Ruthie said our brother already killed two fellas, and that big girl said, oh yeah, you're just a little smarty liar. And Ruthie said, oh yeah, well our brother's a hiding right now from killing a fella, and he can kill that big girl's brother too. And then they called names and Ruthie throwed a rock, and that big girl chased her, and I come home.
Oh my,
Ma said wearily. Oh my dear sweet Lord Jesus asleep in a manger. What we going to do now?
She put her forehead in her hand and rubbed her eyes.
What we gonna do now?
A smell of burning potatoes came from the roaring stove. Ma moved automatically and turned them.
Rosa Sharn, Ma called.
The girl appeared around the curtain.
Come watch this here supper.
Winfield, you go out and you find Ruthie and bring her back here.
Gonna whoop her, Ma?
He asked hopefully.
No. This here you couldn't do nothing about. Why, I wonder, did she have to do it? No, it won't do no good to whoop her. Run now and find her and bring her back.
Winfield ran for the car door, and he met the three men tramping up the catwalk, and he stood aside while they came in. Ma said softly,
Pa, I got to talk to you. Ruthie told some kids how Tom's a hidin'.
What?
She told. Got in a fight and told.
Why, the little bitch.
No, she didn't know what she was a-doing. Now look, Pa. I want you to stay here. I'm going out and try to find Tom and tell him. I got to tell him to be careful. You stick here, Pa, and kind of watch out for things. I'll take him some dinner.
All right, Pa agreed.
Don't you even mention to Ruthie what she done. I'll tell her.
At that moment, Ruthie came in, with Winfield behind her. The little girl was dirtied. Her mouth was sticky, and her nose still dripped a little blood from her fight. She looked shamed and frightened. Winfield triumphantly followed her. Ruthie looked fiercely about, but she went to a corner of the car and put her back in the corner. Her shame and fierceness were blended.
"I told her what she'd done," Winfield said.
Ma was putting two chops and some fried potatoes on a tin plate.
"Hush, Winfield," she said. "They ain't no need to hurt her feelings no more'n what they're hurt."
Ruthie's body hurtled across the car. She grabbed Ma around the middle and buried her head in Ma's stomach, and her strangled sobs shook her whole body. Ma tried to loosen her, but the grubby fingers clung tight. Ma brushed the hair on the back of her head gently, and she patted her shoulders.
Hush, she said. You didn't know.
Ruthie raised her dirty, tear-stained, bloody face.
They stole my cracker, Jack, she cried. That big son of a bitch of a girl, she belted me.
She went off into hard crying again.
Hush, Ma said. Don't talk like that. Here, let go.
I'm a-going now.
Why'd you whoop her, Ma? If she didn't get snotty with her cracker jack, 'twouldn't have happened. Go on, give her a whoop.
You just mind your business, mister, Ma said fiercely. You'll get a whoop yourself. Now let go, Ruthie. Winfield retired to a rolled mattress, and he regarded the family cynically and dully. And he put himself in a good position of defense, for Ruthie would attack him at the first opportunity, and he knew it. Ruthie went quietly, heartbrokenly, to the other side of the car. Ma put a sheet of newspaper over the tin plate.
I'm a-going now, she said.
Ain't you gonna eat nothing yourself? Uncle John demanded.
Later, when I come back. I wouldn't want nothing now.
Ma walked to the open door. She steadied herself down the steep, cleated catwalk. On the stream side of the boxcars, the tents were pitched close together, their guy ropes crossing one another, and the pegs of one at the canvas line of the next. The light shone through the cloth, and all the chimneys belched smoke. Men and women stood in the doorways talking. Children ran feverishly about. Ma moved majestically down the line of tents. Here and there she was recognized as she went by.
Evening, Miss Jode.
Evening. Taking something out, Miss Jode? They's a friend. I'm taking back some bread.
She came at last to the end of the line of tents. She stopped and looked back. A glow of light was on the camp and the soft overtone of a multitude of speakers. Now and then a harsher voice cut through. The smell of smoke filled the air. Someone played a harmonica softly, trying for an effect, one phrase over and over. Ma stepped in among the willows beside the stream. She moved off the trail and waited, silently, listening to hear any possible follower. A man walked down the trail toward the camp, boosting his suspenders and buttoning his jeans as he went. Ma sat very still, and he passed on without seeing her. She waited 5 minutes, and then she stood up and crept on up the trail beside the stream. She moved quietly, so quietly that she could hear the murmur of the water above her soft steps on the willow leaves. Trail and stream swung to the left and then to the right again until they neared the highway. In the gray starlight she could see the embankment and the black round hole of the culvert where she always left Tom's food. She moved forward cautiously, thrust her package into the hole, and took back the empty tin plate which was left there. She crept back among the willows, forced her way into a thicket, and sat down to wait. Through the tangle she could see the black hole of the culvert. She clasped her knees and sat silently. In a few moments the thicket crept to life again. The field mice moved cautiously over the leaves. A skunk padded heavily and unself-consciously down the trail, carrying a faint effluvium with him. And then a wind stirred the willows delicately, as though it tested them, and a shower of golden leaves coasted down to the ground. Suddenly a gust boiled in and racked the trees, and a cricking downpour of leaves fell. Ma could feel them on her hair and on her shoulders. Over the sky a plump black cloud moved, erasing the stars. The fat drops of rain scattered down, splashing loudly on the fallen leaves, and the cloud moved on and unveiled the stars again. Ma shivered. The wind blew past and left the thicket quiet, but the rushing of the trees went on down the stream. From back at the camp came the thin, penetrating tone of a violin feeling about for a tune. Ma heard a stealthy step among the leaves far to her left, and she grew tense. She released her knees and straightened her head, the better to hear. The movement stopped, and after a long moment began again. A vine rasped harshly on the dry leaves. Ma saw a dark figure creep into the open and draw near to the culvert. The black round hole was obscured for a moment, and then the figure moved back. She called softly, "Tom?" The figure stood still, so low to the ground that it might have been a stump. She called again, "Tom! Oh, Tom!" Then the figure moved. "That you, Ma?" "Right over here." She stood up and went to meet him. "You shouldn't have came," he said. "I got to see you, Tom. I got to talk to you." "It's near the trail," he said. "Somebody might come by." "Ain't you got a place, Tom?" "Yeah, but if, well, suppose somebody seen you with me. Whole family'd be in a jam." "I got to, Tom." "Then come along. Come quiet."
He crossed the little stream, wading carelessly through the water, and Ma followed him. He moved through the brush, out into a field on the other side of the thicket, and along the plowed ground. The blackening stems of the cotton were harsh against the ground, and a few fluffs of cotton clung to the stems. A quarter of a mile they went along the edge of the field, and then he turned into the brush again. He approached a great mound of wild blackberry bushes, leaned over and pulled a mat of vines aside.
"You got to crawl in," he said.
Ma went down on her hands and knees. She felt sand under her, and then the black inside of the mound no longer touched her, and she felt Tom's blanket on the ground. He arranged the vines in place again. It was lightless in the cave.
"Where are you, Ma?"
"Here. Right here. Talk soft, Tom."
"Don't worry. I've been living like a rabbit some time."
She heard him unwrap his tin plate.
"Pork chops," she said, "and fried potatoes."
"God almighty, and still warm."
Ma could not see him at all in the blackness, but she could hear him chewing, tearing at the meat and swallowing.
"It's a pretty good hideout," he said.
Ma said uneasily,
"Tom, Ruthie told about you."
She heard him gulp.
"Ruthie? What for?"
"Well, it wasn't her fault. Got in a fight, and says her brother'll lick that other girl's brother. You know how they do. And she told that her brother killed a man and was hidin'."
Tom was chuckling.
"With me, I was always going to get Uncle John after him, but he never would do it. That's just kid talk, Ma. That's all right."
"No, it ain't," Ma said. "Them kids'll tell it around, and then the folks'll hear, and they'll tell around, and pretty soon, well, they're liable to get men out to look, just in case. Tom, you got to go away."
"That's what I said right along. I was always scared somebody'd see you put stuff in that culvert, and then they'd watch."
"I know. But I wanted you near. I was scared for you. I ain't seen you. Can't see you now. How's your face?"
"Getting well quick."
"Come close, Tom. Let me feel it. Come close."
He crawled near. Her reaching hand found his face in the blackness, and her fingers moved down to his nose, and then over his left cheek.
"You got a bad scar, Tom, and your nose is all crooked."
"Maybe that's a good thing. Nobody wouldn't know me, maybe. If my prints wasn't on record, I'd be glad."
He went back to his eating.
"Hush," she said. "Listen."
"It's the wind, Ma. Just the wind."
The gust poured down the stream, and the trees rustled under its passing. She crawled close to his voice.
I want to touch you again, Tom. It's like I'm blind, it's so dark. I want to remember, even if it's only my fingers that remember. You got to go away, Tom.
Yeah, I knowed it from the start.
We made pretty good, she said. I've been squirreling money away. Hold out your hand, Tom. I got $7 here.
I ain't gonna take your money, he said. I'll get along all right.
Hold out your hand, Tom. I ain't gonna sleep none if you got no money. Maybe you got to take a bus or something. I want you should go a long ways off, 300-400 miles.
I ain't gonna take it.
Tom, she said sternly, you take this money. You hear me? You got no right to cause me pain.
You ain't playing fair, he said.
I thought maybe you could go to a big city, Los Angeles maybe. They wouldn't never look for you there.
He said. Looky, Ma, I've been all day and all night hiding alone. Guess who I've been thinking about? Casey. He talked a lot, used to bother me. But now I've been thinking what he said, and I can remember all of it. Says one time he went out in the wilderness to find his own soul, and he found he didn't have no soul that was his'n. Says he found he just got a little piece of a great big soul. Says a wilderness ain't no good, 'cause his little piece of a soul wasn't no good lest it was with the rest and was whole. Funny how I remember. Didn't think I was even listening. But I know now a fella ain't no good alone.
He was a good man, Ma said.
Tom went on. He spouted out some scripture once, and it didn't sound like no hellfire scripture. He told it twice, and I remember it. Says it's from the preacher.
How'd it go, Tom?
Goes, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. That's part of her.
Go on, Ma said. Go on, Tom.
Just a little bit more. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken.
And that's scripture?
Casey said it was. Called it the preacher.
Hush, listen.
Only the wind, Ma. I know the wind. And I got to thinking, Ma, most of the preaching is about the poor we shall always have with us. And if you got nothing, why, just fold your hands and to hell with it. You're gonna get ice cream on gold plates when you're dead. And then this here preacher says two get a better reward for their work.
Tom, she said, what you aiming to do?
He was quiet for a long time.
I've been thinking how it was in that government camp, how our folks took care of theirselves, and if they was a fight, they fixed it theirself, and they wasn't no cops waggling their guns, but they was better order than them cops ever give. I've been a-wondering why we can't do that all over. Throw out the cops that ain't our people. All work together for our own thing. All farm our own land.
Tom, Ma repeated, what you gonna do?
What Casey done, he said.
But they killed him.
Yeah, said Tom. He didn't duck quick enough. He wasn't doing nothing against the law, Ma. I've been thinking a hell of a lot, thinking about our people living like pigs, and the good rich land laying fallow. Or maybe one fella with 1,000,000 acres, while 100,000 good farmers is starving.
and I've been wondering if all our folks got together and yelled, like them fellas yelled, only a few of them at the Hooper Ranch. Ma said, Tom, they'll drive you and cut you down like they done to young Floyd. They gonna drive me anyways. They driving all our people. You don't aim to kill nobody, Tom. No. I've been thinking, long as I'm an outlaw anyways, maybe I could... Hell, I ain't thought it out clear, Ma. Don't worry me now. Don't worry me. They sat silent in the coal-black cave of vines. Ma said, How am I gonna know about you? They might kill you, and I wouldn't know. They might hurt you. How am I gonna know? Tom laughed uneasily. Well, maybe like Casey says, a fella ain't got a soul of his own, but only a piece of a big one. And then... Then what, Tom? Then it don't matter. Then I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere, wherever you look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. If Casey knowed, why, I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad, and I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when our folks eat the stuff they raise and live in the houses they build, why, I'll be there. See? God, I'm talking like Casey. Comes a-thinking about him so much. Seems like I can see him sometimes. I don't understand, Ma said. I don't really know. Me neither, said Tom. It's just stuff I've been thinking about. Get thinking a lot when you ain't moving around. You got to get back, Ma. You take the money, then. He was silent for a moment. All right, he said. And Tom, later, when it's blowed over, you'll come back? You'll find us? Sure, he said. Now you better go. Here, give me your hand. He guided her toward the entrance. Her fingers clutched his wrist. He swept the vines aside and followed her out. Go up to the field till you come to a sycamore on the edge, and then cut across the stream. Goodbye. Goodbye, she said, and she walked quickly away. Her eyes were wet and burning, but she did not cry. Her footsteps were loud and careless on the leaves as she went through the brush, and as she went, out of the dim sky the rain began to fall, big drops and few splashing on the dry leaves heavily. Ma stopped and stood still in the dripping thicket. She turned about, took 3 steps back toward the mound of vines, and then she turned quickly and went back toward the boxcar camp. She went straight out to the culvert and climbed up on the road. The rain had passed now, but the sky was overcast. Behind her on the road she heard footsteps, and she turned nervously. The blinking of a dim flashlight played on the road. Ma turned back and started for home. In a moment a man caught up with her. Politely he kept his light on the ground and did not play it in her face.
"Evening," he said. Ma said, "Howdy." "Looks like we might have a little rain."
"I hope not. Stop the picking. We need the picking."
"I need the picking, too. You live at the camp there?"
"Yes, sir."
Their footsteps beat on the road together. "I got 20 acres of cotton. Little late, but it's ready now. Thought I'd go down and try to get some pickers."
"You'll get 'em all right. Season's near over."
"Hope so. My place is only a mile up that way."
"6 of us," said Ma. 3 men and me and 2 little fellas.
"I'll put out a sign. 2 miles this road.
We'll be there in the morning."
"I hope it don't rain."
"Me too," said Ma. 20 acres won't last long.
The less it lasts, the gladder I'll be. My cotton's late. Didn't get it in till late.
What you paying, mister?
90 cents.
We'll pick. I hear fellas say next year it'll be 75 or even 60.
That's what I hear.
They'll be trouble, said Ma.
Sure, I know. Little fella like me can't do anything. The association sets the rate, and we got to mind. If we don't, we ain't got a farm. Little fella gets crowded all the time.
They came to the camp. We'll be there, Ma said. Not much picking left.
She went to the end boxcar and climbed the cleated walk. The low light of the lantern made gloomy shadows in the car. Pa and Uncle John and an elderly man squatted against the car wall.
Hello, Ma said. Evening, Mr. Wainwright.
He raised a delicately chiseled face. His eyes were deep under the ridges of his brows. His hair was blue-white and fine. A patina of silver beard covered his jaws and chin.
"Evening, ma'am," he said.
"We got picking tomorrow," Ma observed. "Mile north, 20 acres."
"Better take the truck, I guess," Pa said. "Get in more picking."
Wainwright raised his head eagerly.
"Suppose we can pick?"
"Why, sure. I walked a piece with the fella. He was coming to get pickers."
"Cotton's nearly gone. Pretty thin, these here seconds. Gonna be hard to make a wage on the seconds. Got her pretty clean the first time."
"Your folks could maybe ride with us," Ma said. "Split the gas."
"Well, that's friendly of you, ma'am."
"Saves us both," said Ma.
Pa said,
"Mr. Wainwright, he's got a worry he come to us about. We was a-talkin' her over."
"What's the matter?"
Wainwright looked down at the floor.
"Our Aggie," he said. "She's a big girl, near 16 and growed up."
"Aggie's a pretty girl," said Ma.
"Listen him out," Pa said.
"Well, her and your boy Al, they're a-walkin' out every night. And Aggie's a good healthy girl that ought to have a husband, else she might get in trouble. We never had no trouble in our family. But what with us being so poor off now, Ms. Wainwright and me, we got to worrying. Suppose she got in trouble."
Ma rolled down a mattress and sat on it.
"They out now?" she asked.
"Always out," said Wainwright. "Every night."
"Well, Al's a good boy. Kind of figures he's a dunghill rooster these days, but he's a good steady boy. I couldn't want for a better boy."
"Oh, we ain't complaining about Al as a fella. We like him. But what scares Miss Wainwright and me, well, she's a growed-up woman girl. And what if we go away, or you go away, and we find out Aggie's in trouble? We ain't had no shame in our family."
Ma said softly, "We'll try and see that we don't put no shame on you."
He stood up quickly.
"Thank you, ma'am. Aggie's a growed-up woman girl. She's a good girl, just as nice and good. We'll sure thank you, ma'am, if you'll keep shame from us. It ain't Aggie's fault. She's growed up."
"Pa'll talk to Al," said Ma. "Or if Pa won't, I will."
Wainwright said,
"Good night, then, and we sure thank you."
He went around the end of the curtain. They could hear him talking softly in the other end of the car, explaining the result of his embassy. Ma listened a moment, and then,
"You fellas," she said, "come over and sit here."
Pa and Uncle John got heavily up from their squats. They sat on the mattress beside Ma.
"Where's the little fellas?"
Pa pointed to the mattress in the corner.
"Ruthie, she jumped Winfield and bit him. Made them both lay down. Guess they're asleep. Rosa Sharn, she went to set with a lady she knows."
Ma sighed. "I found Tom," she said softly. "I sent him away, far off."
Pa nodded slowly. Uncle John dropped his chin on his chest.
"Couldn't do nothing else," Pa said. "Think he could, John?"
Uncle John looked up.
"I can't think nothing out," he said. Don't seem like I'm hardly awake no more.
Tom's a good boy, Ma said, and then she apologized. I didn't mean no harm saying I'd talk to Al.
I know, Pa said quietly. I ain't no good anymore. Spent all my time a-thinking how it used to be. Spent all my time thinking of home, and I ain't never gonna see it no more.
This here's purtier, better land, said Ma.
I know. I never even see it. Thinking how the willow's lost its leaves now. Sometimes figuring to mend that hole in the south fence. Funny. Woman taking over the family. Woman saying we'll do this here and we'll go there. And I don't even care.
Woman can change better in a man, Ma said soothingly. Woman got all her life in her arms. Man got it all in his head. Don't you mind? Maybe, well, maybe next year we can get a place.
We got nothing now, Pa said. Coming a long time, no work, no crops. What we gonna do then? How we gonna get stuff to eat? And I tell you, Rosa Sharn ain't so far from due. Get so I hate to think. Go digging back to an old time to keep from thinking. Seems like our life's over and done.
No, it ain't, Ma smiled. It ain't, Pa. And that's one more thing a woman knows. I notice that. Man, he lives in jerks. Baby born and a man dies and that's a jerk. Gets a farm and loses a farm and that's a jerk. Woman, it's all one flow, like a stream. Little eddies, little waterfalls. But the river, it goes right on. Woman looks at it like that. We ain't gonna die out. People is going on. Changing a little, maybe, but going right on.
How can you tell? Uncle John demanded. What's to keep everything from stopping? All the folks from just getting tired and laying down.
Ma considered. She rubbed the shiny back of one hand with the other, pushed the fingers of her right hand between the fingers of her left. Hard to say, she said. Everything we do seems to me is aimed right at going on. Seems that way to me. Even getting hungry, even being sick. Some die, but the rest is tougher. Just try to live the day. Just the day.
Uncle John said, If only she didn't die that time.
Just live the day, Ma said. Don't worry yourself.
They might be a good year next year back home, said Pa.
Ma said, Listen.
There were creeping steps on the catwalk, and then Al came in past the curtain.
Hello, he said. I thought you'd be sleeping by now.
Al, Ma said, We're a-talkin'. Come set here.
Sure, okay. I want to talk, too. I'll have to be going away pretty soon now.
You can't. We need you here. Why you got to go away?
Well, me and Aggie Wainwright, we figures to get married. And I'm gonna get a job in a garage, and we'll have a rent house for a while, and...
He looked up fiercely.
Well, we are, and they ain't nobody can stop us.
They were staring at him.
Al, Ma said at last, we're glad. We're awful glad.
You are?
Why, of course we are. You're a growed man. You need a wife. But don't go right now, Al.
I promised Aggie, he said. We got to go. We can't stand this no more.
Just stay till spring, Ma begged. Just till spring. Won't you stay till spring? Who drive the truck?
Well,
Ms. Wainwright put her head around the curtain.
You heard yet?
She demanded.
Yeah, just heard.
Oh, my. I wish we had a cake. I wish we had a cake or something.
I'll set on some coffee and make some pancakes. Ma said, We got syrup.
Oh, my, Mrs. Wainwright said. Why, well, look, I'll bring some sugar. We'll put sugar in them pancakes.
Ma broke twigs into the stove, and the coals from the dinner cooking started them blazing. Ruthie and Winfield came out of their bed like hermit crabs from shells. For a moment they were careful. They watched to see whether they were still criminals. When no one noticed them, they grew bold. Ruthie hopped all the way to the door and back on one foot, without touching the wall. Ma was pouring flour into a bowl when Rose of Sharon climbed the catwalk. She steadied herself and advanced cautiously.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"Why, it's news," Ma cried. "We're going to have a little party. Counter Al and Aggie Wainwright is going to get married." Rose of Sharon stood perfectly still. She looked slowly at Al, who stood there, flustered and embarrassed. Mrs. Wainwright shouted from the other end of the car,
"I'm putting a fresh dress on, Aggie. I'll be right over."
Rose of Sharon turned slowly. She went back to the wide door, and she crept down the catwalk. Once on the ground, she moved slowly toward the stream and the trail that went beside it. She took the way Ma had gone earlier, into the willows. The wind blew more steadily now, and the bushes whished steadily. Rose of Sharon went down on her knees and crawled deep into the brush. The berry vines cut her face and pulled at her hair, but she didn't mind. Only when she felt the bushes touching her all over did she stop. She stretched out on her back, and she felt the weight of the baby inside of her. In the lightless car, Ma stirred, and then she pushed the blanket back and got up. At the open door of the car, the gray starlight penetrated a little. Ma walked to the door and stood looking out. The stars were paling in the east. The wind blew softly over the willow thickets, and from the little stream came the quiet talking of the water. Most of the camp was still asleep, but in front of one tent a little fire burned, and people were standing about it, warming themselves. Ma could see them in the light of the new dancing fire as they stood facing the flames, rubbing their hands, and then they turned their backs and held their hands behind them. For a long moment Ma looked out, and she held her hands clasped in front of her. The uneven wind whisked up and past, and a bite of frost was in the air. Ma shivered and rubbed her hands together. She crept back and fumbled for the matches beside the lantern. The shade screeched up. She lighted the wick, watched it burn blue for a moment, and then put up its yellow, delicately curved ring of light. She carried the lantern to the stove and set it down while she broke the brittle, dry willow twigs into the firebox. In a moment, the fire was roaring up the chimney. Rose of Sharon rolled heavily over and sat up.
"I'll get right up," she said.
"Why don't you lay a minute till it warms?" Ma asked.
"No, I'll get."
Ma filled the coffee pot from the bucket and set it on the stove, and she put on the frying pan, deep with fat, to get hot for the pones.
"What's over you?" she said softly. "I'm a-going out,"
Rose of Sharon said.
"Out where?" "Going out to pick cotton."
"You can't," Ma said. "You're too far along."
"No, I ain't, and I'm a-going."
Ma measured coffee into the water.
"Rose of Sharon, you wasn't to the pancakes last night."
The girl didn't answer.
"What do you want to pick cotton for?"
Still no answer. "Is it 'cause of Al and Aggie?" This time Ma looked closely at her daughter.
"Oh, well, you don't need to pick." "I'm going."
"All right, but don't you strain yourself."
"Get up, Pa. Wake up. Get up."
Pa blinked and yawned.
"Ain't slep out," he moaned. "Must have been on to 11 o'clock when we went down."
"Come on. Get up, all of you, and wash."
The inhabitants of the car came slowly to life, squirmed up out of the blankets, writhed into their clothes.
Ma sliced salt pork into her second frying pan. "Get out and wash," she commanded. A light sprang up in the other end of the car, and there came the sound of the breaking of twigs from the Wainwright end.
"Miss Jode," came the call. "We're getting ready. We'll be ready."
Al grumbled.
"What we got to be up so early for?"
"It's only 20 acres," Ma said. "Got to get there. Ain't much cotton left. Got to be there before she's picked." Ma rushed them dressed, rushed the breakfast into them. "Come on, drink your coffee," she said. "Got to start."
"We can't pick no cotton in the dark, Ma."
"We can be there when it gets light."
"Maybe it's wet."
"Didn't rain enough. Come on now, drink your coffee. Al, soon's you're through, better get the engine running." She called, "You near ready, Ms. Wainwright?"
"Just eatin'. Be ready in a minute."
Outside, the camp had come to life. Fires burned in front of the tents. The stovepipes from the boxcars spurted smoke. Al tipped up his coffee and got a mouthful of grounds. He went down the catwalk, spitting them out. "We're all ready, Miss Wainwright," Ma called. She turned to Rose of Sharon. She said, "You got to stay." The girl set her jaw.
"I'm a-goin'," she said. "Ma, I got to go."
"Well, you got no cotton sack. You can't pull no sack."
"I'll pick into your sack."
"I wished you wouldn't."
"I'm a-goin'."
Ma sighed.
"I'll keep my eye on you. Wish we could have a doctor."
Rose of Sharon moved nervously about the car. She put on a light coat and took it off.
"Take a blanket," Ma said. "Then if you want to rest, you can keep warm."
They heard the truck motor roar up behind the boxcar. "We gonna be first out," Ma said exultantly. "All right, get your sacks. Ruthie, don't you forget them shirts I fixed for you to pick in." Wainwrights and Jodes climbed into the truck in the dark. The dawn was coming, but it was slow and pale. "Turn left," Ma told Al. "There'll be a sign out where we're going." They drove along the dark road, and other cars followed them. And behind in the camp, the cars were being started, the families piling in, and the cars pulled out on the highway and turned left. A piece of cardboard was tied to a mailbox on the right-hand side of the road, and on it, printed with blue crayon, "Cotton pickers wanted." Al turned into the entrance and drove out to the barnyard, and the barnyard was full of cars already. An electric globe on the end of the white barn lighted a group of men and women standing near the scales, their bags rolled under their arms. Some of the women wore the bags over their shoulders and crossed in front.
"We ain't so early as we thought," said Al.
He pulled the truck against a fence and parked. The families climbed down and went to join the waiting group, and more cars came in from the road and parked, and more families joined the group. Under the light on the barn end, the owner signed them in.
"Hawley," he said, "H-A-W-L-E-Y.
"How many?"
"4. "Will?" "Well." "Benton?"
"Benton."
"Amelia?"
"Amelia."
"Claire?"
"Claire." "Who's next?" "Carpenter? How many?"
6.
He wrote them in the book, with a space left for the weights.
"Got your bags? I got a few. Cost you $1.
And the cars poured into the yard. The owner pulled his sheep-lined leather jacket up around his throat. He looked at the driveway apprehensively.
"This 20 isn't going to take long to pick with all these people," he said.
Children were climbing into the big cotton trailer, digging their toes into the chicken wire sides.
"Get off there," the owner cried. "Come on down. You'll tear that wire loose."
And the children climbed slowly down, embarrassed and silent. The gray dawn came.
"I'll have to take a tear for dew," the owner said. "Change it when the sun comes out. All right, go out when you want, light enough to see."
The people moved quickly out into the cotton field and took their rows.
They tied the bags to their waists, and they slapped their hands together to warm, stiff fingers that had to be nimble. The dawn colored over the eastern hills, and the wide line moved over the rows. And from the highway the car still moved in and parked in the barnyard until it was full, and they parked along the road on both sides. The wind blew briskly across the field.
"I don't know how you all found out," the owner said. "There must be a hell of a grapevine. The 20 won't last till noon. What name? Hume? How many?"
The line of people moved out across the field, and the strong, steady west wind blew their clothes. Their fingers flew to the spilling bowls and flew to the long sacks growing heavy behind them. Pa spoke to the man in the row to his right.
"Back home we might get rain out of a wind like this. Seems a little mite frosty for rain. How long you been out here?"
He kept his eyes down on his work as he spoke. His neighbor didn't look up.
"I been here nearly a year."
"Would you say it was gonna rain?"
"Can't tell, and that ain't no insult, neither. Folks that lived here all their life can't tell. If the rain can get in the way of a crop, it'll rain. That's what they say out here."
Pa looked quickly at the western hills. Big gray clouds were coasting over the ridge, riding the wind swiftly.
"Them looks like rain heads," he said.
His neighbor stole a squinting look.
"Can't tell," he said.
And all down the line of rows, the people looked back at the clouds, and then they bent lower to their work, and their hands flew to the cotton. They raced at the picking, raced against time and cotton weight, raced against the rain and against each other. Only so much cotton to pick, only so much money to be made. They came to the other side of the field and ran to get a new row. And now they faced into the wind, and they could see the high gray clouds moving over the sky toward the rising sun. And more cars parked along the roadside, and new pickers came to be checked in. The line of people moved frantically across the field, weighed at the end, marked their cotton, checked the weights into their own books, and ran for new rows. At 11 o'clock, the field was picked, and the work was done. The wire-sided trailers were hooked on behind wire-sided trucks, and they moved out to the highway and drove away to the gin. The cotton fluffed out through the chicken wire, and little clouds of cotton blew through the air, and rags of cotton caught and waved on the weeds beside the road. The pickers clustered disconsolately back to the barnyard and stood in line to be paid off.
"Hume, James, 22 cents. Ralph, 30 cents. Jode, Thomas, 90 cents. Winfield, 15 cents.
The money lay in rolls, silver and nickels and pennies, and each man looked in his own book as he was being paid. Wainwright, Agnes, 34 cents. Tobin, 63 cents. The line moved past slowly. The families went back to their cars silently, and they drove slowly away. Jodes and Wainwrights waited in the truck for the driveway to clear, and as they waited, the first drops of rain began to fall. Al put his hand out of the cab to feel them. Rose of Sharon sat in the middle, and Ma on the outside. The girl's eyes were lusterless again.
"You shouldn't have came," Ma said. "You didn't pick more'n 10-15 pounds.
Rose of Sharon looked down at her great, bulging belly, and she didn't reply. She shivered suddenly and held her head high. Ma, watching her closely, unrolled her cotton bag, spread it over Rose of Sharon's shoulders, and drew her close. At last the way was clear. Al started his motor and drove out into the highway. The big, infrequent drops of rain lanced down and splashed on the road, and as the truck moved along, the drops became smaller and closer. Rain pounded on the cab of the truck so loudly that it could be heard over the pounding of the old worn motor. On the truck bed, the Wainwrights and Jodes spread their cotton bags over their heads and shoulders. Rose of Sharon shivered violently against Ma's arm, and Ma cried,
"Go faster, Al. Rose of Sharon got a chill. Gotta get her feet in hot water."
Al speeded the pounding motor, and when he came to the boxcar camp, he drove down close to the red cars. Ma was spouting orders before they were well stopped. "Al," she commanded, "you and John and Pa go into the willows and collect all the dead stuff you can. We got to keep warm." "Wonder if the roof leaks?" "No, I don't think so. Be nice and dry, but we got to have wood. Got to keep warm. Take Ruthie and Winfield, too. They can get twigs. This here girl ain't well." Ma got out, and Rose of Sharon tried to follow, but her knees buckled and she sat down heavily on the running board. Fat Mrs. Wainwright saw her.
"What's the matter? Her time come?"
"No, I don't think so," said Ma. "Got a chill. Maybe took cold. Give me a hand, will you?" The two women supported Rose of Sharon. After a few steps, her strength came back. Her legs took her weight. "I'm all right, Ma," she said. "It was just a minute there." The older woman kept hands on her elbows. "Feet in hot water," Ma said wisely. They helped her up the catwalk and into the boxcar.
"You rub her," Mrs. Wainwright said. "I'll get a fire going."
She used the last of the twigs and built up a blaze in the stove. The rain poured now, scoured at the roof of the car. Ma looked up at it. "Thank God we got a tight roof," she said. "Them tents leaks, no matter how good. Just put on a little water, Ms. Wainwright." Rose of Sharon still lay on a mattress. She let them take off her shoes and rub her feet. Mrs. Wainwright bent over her.
"You got pain?" she demanded.
"No, just don't feel good. Just feel bad."
"I got painkiller and salts," Mrs. Wainwright said. "You're welcome to 'em if you want 'em. Perfectly welcome."
The girl shivered violently. "Cover me up, Ma. I'm cold." Ma brought all the blankets and piled them on top of her. The rain roared down on the roof. Now the wood gatherers returned, their arms piled high with sticks and their hats and coats dripping.
"Jesus, she's wet," Pa said. "Soaks you in a minute."
Ma said, "Better go back and get more. Burns up awful quick. Be dark pretty soon." Ruthie and Winfield dripped in and threw their sticks on the pile. They turned to go again. "You stay," Ma ordered. "Stand up close to the fire and get dry." The afternoon was silver with rain. The roads glittered with water. Hour by hour, the cotton plants seemed to blacken and shrivel. Pa and Al and Uncle John made trip after trip into the thickets and brought back loads of dead wood. They piled it near the door until the heap of it nearly reached the ceiling, and at last they stopped and walked toward the stove. Streams of water ran from their hats to their shoulders. The edges of their coats dripped and their shoes squished as they walked. "All right now, get off them clothes," Ma said. "I got some nice coffee for you fellas, and you got dry overhauls to put on. Don't stand there." The evening came early. In the boxcars, the families huddled together, listening to the pouring water on the roofs. Chapter 29. Over the high coast mountains and over the valleys, the gray clouds marched in from the ocean. The wind blew fiercely and silently, high in the air, and it swished in the brush and it roared in the forests. The clouds came in brokenly, in puffs and folds and gray crags, and they piled in together and settled low over the west. And then the wind stopped and left the clouds deep and solid. The rain began with gusty showers, pauses, and downpours, and then gradually it settled to a single tempo, small drops and a steady beat, rain that was gray to see through, rain that cut midday light to evening. And at first the dry earth sucked the moisture down and blackened. For 2 days the earth drank the rain until the earth was full. Then puddles formed,
and in the low places little lakes formed in the fields. The muddy lakes rose higher, and the steady rain whipped the shining water.